silver-gray cloaks, and swords at their belts. Maggie recognized their leader at once. It was Fire Fox, and judging by his face, he didn't seem to like traveling on foot very much.
"Don't stare at them like that,"
whispered Farid as Maggie stood there rooted to the spot. He dragged her behind one of the carts standing around the yard.
"Your mother's not hurt. Did you see her?"
Maggie nodded.
"Yes. Risa was walking between two other women, one of them pregnant. But where was Mo?"
"Hey!"
bellowed Fire Fox as his men drove the prisoners into the yard.
"Whose are those carts? We need more room!"
The soldiers pushed the carts aside, handling one of them so roughly that its load of sacks slipped off. A man hurried out of the inn, probably the cart's owner, a protest already on his lips, but when he saw the soldiers, he bit it back and shouted at the grooms, who quickly righted the cart again. Traders, farmers, servants, more and more people came crowding out of the stables in the main building to see the cause of all the noise in the yard. A fat, perspiring man made his way through the turmoil to Fire Fox, faced him with a hostile expression, and let fly a torrent of angry words.
"All right, all right,"
Maggie heard Fire Fox growl.
"But we need space. Can't you see we have prisoners with us? Would you rather we drove them into your stables?"
"Yes, yes, use one of the stables,"
cried the fat man in relief, beckoning to a couple of his servants who were standing there staring at the prisoners, some of whom had fallen to their knees just where they were, their faces pale with exhaustion and fear.
"Come on,"
Farid whispered to Maggie, and side by side they pushed their way past the muttering farmers and traders, past the servants still clearing the burst sacks out of the yard, past the soldiers casting hopeful glances at the inn. No one seemed to be taking very much notice of the prisoners, but it was hardly necessary. None of them looked as if they still had the strength to escape. Even the children, whose legs might have been fast enough for them to run, were clinging to their mother's skirts, empty-eyed, or staring in fear at the armed men who had brought them here. Risa was supporting the pregnant woman. Yes, her mother was uninjured. Maggie could see that much, although she avoided coming too close to her, in case Dustfinger was right to fear that Risa would give herself away if she recognized her. How desperately she was looking around. She took the arm of a soldier whose beardless face made him look only a boy. And then,
"Farid!"
Maggie couldn't believe it. Risa was talking. Not with her hands, but with her mouth. Her voice could hardly be heard in all this noise, but it was her voice. How could it be possible? The soldier didn't listen to her, but pushed her roughly away, and Risa turned. The Black Prince and his bear were pulling a cart into the yard. They had been harnessed to it like oxen. A chain was wound round the bear's black muzzle, another around his throat and chest, but Risa had eyes for neither the bear nor the prince. She kept looking at the cart, and Maggie immediately realized what that meant. Without a word, she took off.
"Maggie!"
Farid called after her, but she wasn't listening. No one could stop her. The cart was a ramshackle thing. First she saw only the man with the injured leg, one of the strolling players holding a child on his lap. Then she saw Mo. She thought her heart would never beat again. He was lying there with his eyes closed, under a dirty blanket, but all the same Maggie saw the blood. His shirt was soaked in it, the shirt he liked best to wear, although the sleeves had worn thin. Maggie forgot everything, Farid, the soldiers, Dustfinger's warning, where she was, why she was here. She just stared at her father in his still face. The world was suddenly an empty place, very empty, and her heart was a cold, dead thing.
"Maggie!"
Farid reached for her arm. He hauled her away with him, ignoring her resistance, but he held her close when she began to sob.
"He's dead, Farid! Did you see him? Bo, he's dead!"
She kept stammering that terrible word. Dead. Gone. Forever. She pushed Farid's arm away.
"I must go to him!"
"Bad luck clings to this book, Maggie. Nothing but bad luck. Even if you don't believe me." Hadn't he told her that in Eleanor's library? How much every one of those words hurt now. Death had been waiting in the book. His death.
"Maggie!"
Farid was still holding her firmly. He shook her as if he had to wake her up.
"Maggie, listen, he's not dead. Do you think they'd be dragging him along with them if he was?"
Would they? She wasn't sure of anything anymore.
"Come with me, come on."
Farid pulled her away with him. He pushed his way casually through the crowd as if none of the hurry and bustle interested him. Finally, with an indifferent expression on his face, he stopped by the stable into which the soldiers were herding the prisoners. Maggie wiped away her tears and tried to look equally indifferent. But how could she, when her heart, coming back to life, felt as if someone had cut it in two?
"Do you have enough for us to eat there?"
she heard Firefox ask.
"We're ravenous after that journey through that accursed forest."
Maggie saw them push Risa into the dark stable with the other women, while two soldiers released the Black Prince and his bear.
"Of course I have enough," said the fat landlord indignantly. "And you won't recognize your horses. Their coats are so glossy."
"So I should hope," replied Firefox. "Otherwise, the Adderhead will make sure you're not landlord of this hovel much longer. We ride at daybreak tomorrow. My men and the prisoners can stay in the stable, but I want a bed. And a bed to myself, too. Not one I have to share with a crowd of snoring, farting strangers."
"Of course, of course," the landlord nodded eagerly. "But what about that monster?"
He pointed anxiously at the bear.
"He'll scare the horses. Why don't you kill him and leave him in the forest?"
"Because the Adderhead wants to hang him along with his master," replied Firefox. "And because my men believe all the nonsense they hear about him. Folks say he's a nightmare who likes to take the shape of a bear, so it's a bad idea to fire an arrow into his coat."
"A nightmare,
the landlord chuckled nervously. He obviously seemed to think the story not impossible.
"Never mind what he is, he's not going into my stable. Tie him up behind the bakehouse if you like. Perhaps the horses won't smell him."
The bear growled in a low tone as one of the soldiers pulled him along on his chain. But as they were forced away behind the main building, the Black Prince spoke to him soothingly, in a quiet voice, as if comforting a child. The cart with Mo and the injured old man on it was still in the yard. A few servants were standing around, gossiping to one another, presumably trying to work out exactly who had been captured on the Adderhead's orders. Was the rumor already spreading that the man lying as if dead on the cart was the Blue Jay? The soldier with the beardless face shooed away the servants, took the child off the cart, and pushed him toward the stable, too.
"What about the wounded prisoners?"
he called to Firefox.
"Do we just leave those two on the cart where they are? And find that they're dead in the morning or gone. What are you thinking of, you fool? One of them's the reason why we went into that damned forest, right?"
Firefox turned to the landlord again.
"Is there a physician among your guests?" he asked. "I have a prisoner who must be kept alive because the Adderhead plans a magnificent execution for him. It's no real fun with a dead man, if you see what I mean."
"He must be kept alive." Farid pressed Maggie's hand and smiled triumphantly at her.
"Yeah, yes, of course, of course."
The landlord looked curiously at the cart.
"It's a nuisance for sure if condemned men die before their execution. I hear that's happened twice this year already. However, can't offer you a physician. I do have a moss woman helping out in the kitchen, though. She's set many of my guests to rights in her time."
"Good. Send for her."
The landlord impatiently beckoned to a boy leaning by the stable door. Firefox called two of his soldiers to him.
"Go on, get the wounded men into the stable, too," Maggie heard him say. "Double the guards outside the door, and four of you keep watch on the Blue Jay tonight. Understand? No wine, no mead, and anyone who falls asleep will be sorry for it."
"The Blue Jay?"
The landlord stared in amazement.
"You have the Blue Jay on that cart?"
When Firefox cast him a warning glance, he quickly put his fat fingers to his mouth.
"Not a word. No one will hear a word of it from me."
"I should hope not," growled Firefox and looked around as if to make sure that no one else had heard what he said. When the soldiers lifted Mo off the cart, Maggie instinctively took a step forward, but Farid dragged her back.
"Maggie, what's the matter with you?" he hissed. "If you carry on like this, they'll shut you up too. Do you think that will help anyone?"
Maggie shook her head.
"He really is still alive, Farid, isn't he?"
she whispered. She was almost afraid to believe it.
"Yes, of course. I told you so. Don't look so sad. Everything will turn out all right. You wait and see."
Farid caressed her forehead and kissed the tears from her eyelashes.
Hey, you two lovebirds, get away from the horses!
The piper was standing before them. Maggie bent her head, although she was sure he wouldn't recognize her. She'd been just a girl in a dirty dress when he almost rode her down in the Ombra marketplace. Today, he was once again more splendidly clothed than any of the strolling players Maggie had yet seen. His silken garments shimmered like a peacock's tail, and the rings on his fingers were genuine silver, like the nose on his face. Obviously, the adder had paid well for songs that pleased him. The piper looked hard at them again, and then strolled over to Firefox.
"Well, you're back from the forest," he called from some way off. "And with rich booty, so I've heard. Looks as if one of your spies wasn't lying for a change. Good news for the Adderhead at last."
Firefox replied, but Maggie wasn't listening. The snotty-nosed boy came back with the moss woman, a short little creature who hardly came up to his shoulder. Her skin was gray as beech bark, her face as wrinkled as a shriveled apple. Moss women. Healers. Before Farid realized what she meant to do, Maggie had slipped away from him. The moss woman would know how Mo really was. She made her way as close as she could to the little woman, until only the boy stood between them. The moss woman's smock was stained with meat juices from the spit, and her feet were bare, but she inspected the men standing around her with fearless eyes.
"Sure as I live, a genuine moss woman," growled Firefox, while his men retreated from the tiny woman as if she were as dangerous as the Black Prince's bear.
"I thought they never came out of the forest. But yes, apparently they know something about healing. Don't folks say that old Witch Nettle's mother was a moss woman?"
"Yes, but her father was useless."
The little woman scrutinized Firefox as intently as if she were trying to find out what kind of blood flowed in his veins.
"You drink too much," she observed. "Just look at your face. Carry on like this, and your liver will soon burst like an overripe pumpkin."
A ripple of laughter ran through the onlookers, but a glance from Firefox silenced them.
"Listen, you're not here to give me advice, she-gnome," he snapped at the moss woman. "I want you to look at one of my prisoners. He has to reach the Adderhead's castle alive."
"Yes, I know all that," replied the moss woman, still examining his face with disapproval. "So that your master can kill him by all the rules of the executioner's trade. Fetch me water, hot water, and clean towels, and I want someone to help me."
Firefox nodded to the boy.
"If you want a helper, pick one for yourself," he growled,
and surreptitiously felt his stomach where he presumably supposed his liver was located.
"One of your men? No, thank you."
The moss woman wrinkled up her nose scornfully and looked around until her eye fell on Maggie.
"That one will do," said the little creature. "She doesn't look too stupid."
And before Maggie knew it, one of the soldiers took her roughly by the shoulder. The last thing she saw before she stumbled into the stable after the moss woman was the expression of alarm on Farid's face. Chapter 42. A Familiar Face. Mo was conscious as the moss woman kneeled down beside him. He sat leaning back against the damp wall, his eyes searching all the prisoners crouching in the dimly lit stable, looking for Reese's face. He didn't see Maggie until the little woman impatiently beckoned her over. Of course he realized at once that even a smile would have given her away, but it was so hard for him not to take her in his arms, so hard to hide the joy and fear that struggled for his heart at the sight of her.
"What are you standing around for?" the old woman snapped at Maggie. "Come here, you stupid thing."
Mo could have shaken her, but Maggie just kneeled down quickly beside her and took the blood-stained bandages that the old woman was none too gently cutting away from his chest. "Don't stare at her," thought Mo, forcing his eyes to look anywhere else, at the old woman's hands, at the other prisoners, not at his daughter. Had Risa seen her too? She's all right, he thought. Yes, definitely. She wasn't any thinner than usual, and she didn't seem to be sick or injured either. If only he could have at least exchanged a word with her.
By fairy spit, what's the matter with you?
Asked the little woman roughly as Maggie almost spilled the water she was handing her.
I might just as well have taken one of the soldiers.
She began feeling Mo's injuries with her bark-like fingers. It hurt, but he clenched his teeth so that Maggie wouldn't notice.
Are you always so hard on her?
He asked the old woman. The little moss woman muttered something incomprehensible without looking at him, but Maggie ventured a quick glance, and he smiled at her, hoping she wouldn't notice the concern in his eyes, his alarm at seeing her again in this of all places, among all the soldiers. Be careful, Maggie, he tried to tell her with his eyes. How her lips were quivering, probably with all the words that she couldn't say aloud any more than he could. But it was so good to see her, even in this place. In all those days and nights of fever, he had so often felt sure that he would never see her face again.
Hurry up, can't you?
Suddenly Firefox was standing right behind Maggie, and at the sound of his voice she quickly bowed her head and held out the bowl of water to the little old woman again.
Ooh, this is a nasty wound,
remarked the moss woman.
I'm surprised you're still alive.
Yes. Strange, isn't it? Mo was as much aware of Maggie's glance as if it were the pressure of her hand. Perhaps the fairies whispered a few words of healing in my ear.
Words of healing?
The moss woman wrinkled up her nose.
What kind of words would those be? Fairies' gossip is as stupid and useless as fairies themselves.
Well, then someone else must have whispered them to me. Mo saw how pale Maggie turned as she helped the moss woman to rebandage his wound, the wound that hadn't killed him. It's nothing, Maggie, he wanted to say. I'm fine. But all he could do was look at her again, only in passing, as if her face meant no more to him than any other. Believe it or not, he told the old woman, I did hear the words, beautiful words. At first I thought it was my wife's voice, and then I realized it was my daughter's. I heard her voice as clearly as if she were sitting here beside me.
Yes, yes, folk hear all kinds of things in a fever,
replied the moss woman brusquely.
I've heard of those as for the dead spoke to them, the dead, angels, demons. A fever will summon up whole troops of them.
She turned to Firefox.
I have an ointment that will help him, she said, and I'll brew something for him to drink. I can't do any more.
When she turned her back on them, Maggie quickly put her hand on Mo's fingers. No one noticed, nor did they notice the gentle pressure he gave her hand in return. He smiled at her again, and only when the moss woman turned again did he quickly look aside.
You ought to look at his leg, too,
he said, nodding toward the strolling player lying asleep beside him on the straw, exhausted.
No, she oughtn't,
Firefox interrupted.
It's all one to me whether he lives or dies. You're different.
Oh, I see.
You still think I'm that robber? Mo leaned his head against the wall and closed his eyes for a moment. I suppose it's no good if I tell you again that I'm not. By way of answer, Firefox just cast him a contemptuous glance.
Tell the adder head. Perhaps he'll believe you, he said.
Then he pulled Maggie roughly to her feet.
Go on, off with you both. That'll do,
he shouted at her and the moss woman. His men pushed them both toward the stable door. Maggie tried to look around again, her eyes searching for her mother sitting somewhere among the other prisoners, and looking toward Mo yet again, but Firefox grabbed her arm and forced her out of the door, leaving Mo wishing he had words at his command, words like those that had killed Capricorn. His tongue longed to taste them, longed to send them after Firefox and see him fall in the dust like his former master. But there was no one here to write the words for him. Only Finolio's story was everywhere, surrounding them with horror and darkness. And presumably his own death was already planned for one of the next chapters. Chapter 43 Paper and Fire. Dustfinger saw the windows of the inn glowing like dirty yellow eyes as he stole across the road. Jinx scurried ahead of him, little more than a shadow in the darkness. There was no moon tonight, and it was so dark in the yard and around the stables that even his own scarred face would look just like a pale patch. There were guards outside the stable where the prisoners had been shut up. Four guards, but they didn't notice him. They were staring into the night, their faces bored, hands on their sword hilts, looking longingly again and again at the lighted windows opposite. Loud, drunken voices came from the inn, and then the sound of a lute, its strings well plucked, followed by singing in a curiously strained voice. So, the piper was back from Ombra too, and singing one of his songs, drunk with blood and the intoxication of killing. The presence of the man with the silver nose was yet another reason why he had to stay out of sight. Meggie and Farid were waiting behind the stables, as agreed, but they were arguing in such loud voices that Dustfinger came up behind the boy and put his hand over his mouth.
"What you think you're doing?" he said angrily, his voice low. "Do you want them to put you two in with the others?"
Meggie bowed her head. She had tears in her eyes again.
"She wants to go into the stable," Farid whispered. "She thinks they'll all be asleep, as if..."
Dustfinger closed the boy's mouth with his hand again. Voices rang out over the yard. Obviously, someone had brought the guards outside the stable something to eat.
"Where's the Black Prince?" he whispered when all was still again.
"Between the bakehouse and the main building. Tell her she can't go back into that stable. There are at least 15 soldiers in there."
"How many guarding the prince?"
"Three."
"Three." Dustfinger glanced up at the sky. No moon. It was hidden behind the clouds, and the darkness was black as a cloak.
"Are you going to free him? Three aren't many."
Farid sounded excited. Not a trace of fear in his voice. That fearlessness would be the death of him yet.
"We can cut their throats before they make a sound. It'll be easy."
He often said such things. Dustfinger kept wondering if it was just talk, or if he'd actually done something of the kind in the past.
"I can tell you're ready for anything," he said softly. "But you know very well I'm no good at cutting throats. How many prisoners are there?"
11 women, 3 children, 9 men, not counting Silvertongue."
"How is he?"
Dustfinger looked at Maggie.
"Have you seen him? Can he walk?"
She shook her head.
"What about your mother?"
She cast him a quick glance. She didn't like it when he mentioned Risa.
"Come on, is she all right?"
"I think so." She put one hand to the stable wall as if she could feel her parents behind it. "But I didn't get a chance to talk to her. Please." How pleadingly she was looking at him. "I'm sure they're all asleep. I'll be very careful." Farid cast a despairing glance up at the stars as if such stupidity would make them break their eternal silence.
"The guards won't sleep," said Dustfinger. "So think up a good lie for them. Do you have anything to write with?"
Maggie looked at him incredulously, and for a moment Dustfinger saw her mother's eyes. Then she quickly put her hand into the bag that she carried with her.
"I have some paper with me," she whispered, hastily tearing a page out of her little marbled notebook.
Like mother, like daughter. Never without a means of writing.
"You're letting her do it?"
Farid looked at him in astonishment.
"Yes."
Maggie looked at him expectantly.
"Write that there'll be a fallen tree lying across the road they take tomorrow. When it catches fire, everyone strong and young enough must run into the forest to the left. To the left, that's important. Write down that we'll be waiting there to hide them. Did you get that down?"
Maggie nodded. Her pencil hurried over the paper. He could only hope that Risa would be able to decipher the tiny handwriting in the darkness of the stable, because he wouldn't be there to make fire for her.
"Have you thought what you're going to tell the guards?" he asked.
Maggie nodded. For a moment, she looked almost like the little girl she had still been, not much more than a year ago, and Dustfinger wondered whether it was a mistake, after all, to let her go. But before he could change his mind, she was off. She raced over the yard and disappeared into the inn. When she came back, she was carrying a jug.
"Please! The moss woman sent me!"
They heard her clear voice telling the guards,
"I'm to take the children milk."
"Look at the
clever as a jackal," whispered Farid as the guards moved aside, "and brave as a lioness."
There was so much admiration in his voice that Dustfinger couldn't help smiling. The boy was definitely in love.
"Yeah, she's probably cleverer than both of us put together," he whispered back. "And certainly braver, at least as far as I'm concerned."
Farid just nodded. He was staring at the open stable door, and smiled with relief when Maggie came out again.
"See that?"
she whispered to him when she was back beside Farid.
"That's perfectly easy."
"Good," said Dustfinger, beckoning Farid over to his side. "Then let's cross our fingers and hope that what we have to do now is as easy. What about you, Farid? Do you feel like playing with fire?"
The boy carried out his task with as cool a head as Maggie, apparently lost to the world, but in a spot where the men guarding the prince had a clear view of him, he began making fire dance as naturally as if he were standing in some peaceful marketplace, not in front of an inn that sheltered Firefox and the Piper. The guards nudged each other, laughed, glad of something to pass the time this sleepless night.
"Seems that I'm the only one here whose heart's beating faster," thought Dustfinger as he stole past heaps of stinking offal and rotting vegetables.
It looked as if the fat landlord's cook simply threw everything they couldn't serve to the guests out here behind the house. A few rats scurried off when they heard Dustfinger's footsteps, and the hungry eyes of a brownie glowed among the bushes. They had tied up the prince next to a mountain of carcasses, and his bear just far enough away to keep him from reaching the bones. He squatted there, snorting unhappily through his muzzle, which was bound, now and then uttering a miserably muted howl. The guards had stuck a torch in the ground not far away, but the flame went out at once when the wind carried Dustfinger's quiet voice to it. Nothing was left but a faint glow, and the Black Prince raised his head. He knew at once who must be slinking around in the dark when the fire so suddenly died down. A few more quick and silent steps, and Dustfinger took cover behind the bear's furry back.
"That boy's really good," whispered the prince without turning around.
A sharp knife would soon deal with the ropes binding him.
"Yeah, very good. Afraid of nothing, unlike me."
Dustfinger examined the padlocks on the bear's chains. They were rusty, but not particularly difficult to open.
"What you say to a little walk in the forest, but the bear must be quiet. Quietness now, can he do it?"
He ducked when one of the guards turned, but the man had obviously just heard the maid who was coming out of the kitchen to tip a bucket of refuse onto the garbage heaps behind the building. She disappeared again with a curious look at the bound prince, and took with her the noise that had come spilling out of the doorway.
"What about the others?"
4 guards outside the stable, another 4 told by Firefox to guard Silvertongue, and there must be 10 more guarding the other prisoners. It's unlikely that we can distract the attention of all of them, certainly not long enough to get the injured and the crippled to safety.
Silvertongue?
Yes. The man they were looking for in your camp.
What do you call him?
A padlock sprang open. The bear growled. Perhaps Jink was making him uneasy. The second chain had better stay where it was for now, or he'd probably eat the marten. Dustfinger set about cutting up the ropes tying the Black Prince. He had to hurry, for they must be gone before Farid's arms tired. The second padlock clicked. Another quick glance at the boy.
"By the fire of elves," thought Dustfinger, "how he throws the torches almost as high as I do now."
But just as the prince was throwing off his ropes, a fat man marched up to Farid with the maid and a soldier behind him. He shouted at the boy and pointed indignantly at the flames. Farid just smiled, skipped back while Gwyn leaped around his legs, and went on juggling the burning torches. Oh, yes, he was as clever as Maggie. Dustfinger signed to the prince to go with him. The bear groped his way along after them, following his master's low voice. A pity he really was only a bear, and not a nightmare. There had been no need to tell one of those to keep quiet. But at least he was black as his master, and the night swallowed them up as if they were a part of it.
"We'll meet down on the road by the fallen tree."
The prince nodded and disappeared into the darkness. As for Dustfinger, he set off in search of the boy and Reese's daughter. The soldiers were all shouting in confusion in the yard now that it was clear that the Black Prince had escaped. Even the piper had come out of the inn, but neither Farid nor the girl could be seen. The soldiers began searching the outskirts of the forest and the slope behind the house, carrying torches. Dustfinger whispered words into the night until the fire felt sleepy, and torch after torch was extinguished as if the slight breeze had blown them out. The men stopped in the middle of the road, feeling uneasy, and looked around with eyes full of fear. Fear of the dark, fear of the bear, fear of everything else that roamed the woods by night. None of them dared go as far as the place where the fallen tree was blocking the road. The forest and the hills were as quiet as if no human foot had ever trodden there. Gwyn was perched on the tree trunk, and Fareed and Maggie were waiting on the other side under the trees. The boy had a bleeding lip, and the girl laid her head wearily against his shoulder. Embarrassed, she straightened up as Dustfinger emerged in front of them.
"Is he free?" asked Fareed.
Dustfinger put a hand under his chin and looked at the split lip.
"Yes. Whatever happens tomorrow, the prince and his bear will lend us a hand. How'd you do that?"
The two Martins scurried past him and disappeared into the forest side by side.
It's nothing. One of the soldiers tried to grab me, but I got away.
Well, tell me, was I good?
As if he didn't know the answer.
So good that I'm beginning to worry. If you carry on like this, I'll soon be out of a job.
Fareed smiled. How sad Maggie looked, though. She seemed as lost as the child they had found in a looted camp. It wasn't difficult to imagine how she was feeling, even if, like Dustfinger himself, you had never known your parents. Acrobats, some of the women among the strolling players, a traveling physician, he had had many substitutes for them. Any of the motley folk who looked after abandoned children were like their parents.
"We'll say something to her, Dustfinger, anything," he thought.
"You often used to cheer up her mother. Though usually it was just for a short time. Stolen time."
"Listen." He kneeled down in front of Maggie and looked at her.
"If we really manage to free some of them tomorrow, the Black Prince will take them to safety. But the three of us will follow the others."
She looked at him as distrustfully as if he were a worn tightrope that she must walk high in the air. "Why?" she asked quietly. When she spoke in a low voice, you didn't guess at the power that her voice could exert. "Why do you want to help them?" She didn't have to spell it out.
"Last time you didn't, back in Capricorn's village."
What could he say? That it was easier to stand by and watch in a strange world than in your own?
"Let's see, I may have something to make up for," he said at last.
He knew he didn't have to explain what he meant. They both remembered that night, in another tale, when he had betrayed her to Capricorn. "And there's something else, too," he almost added.
"I think your mother has been a captive long enough,"
but he didn't say that. He knew that Maggie wouldn't have liked it. A good hour later, the Black Prince joined them, uninjured, and with his bear. Chapter 44 The Burning Tree. Reese's feet were bleeding. The road was stony and wet with the morning dew. They all had their hands bound again, except the children. She had been terrified that the soldiers wouldn't let them walk with the other prisoners, but would load them onto the cart instead.
"Cry if they try to make you get up there," she had whispered to the little ones. "Cry and scream until they let you walk with us."
But luckily that hadn't been necessary. How scared the three children looked, two girls and a boy, not counting the baby still inside Mina's belly. The elder girl, who was just 6, was walking between Risa and Mina. Whenever Risa glanced at her, she wondered what Maggie had looked like at that age. Mo had shown her photographs, wonderful photographs taken in all the years she herself had missed. But those weren't her own memories, but his, and Maggie's. Brave Maggie. Reese's heart still contracted when she remembered how her daughter had passed her the sheet of paper in the stable. Where was she now? Was she watching them from somewhere in the forest? Only when the hue and cry over the Black Prince had broken out had she been able to read the writing on the paper by the light of the torch left burning overnight in the stable. None of the others could read, so she had been able to pass on Dustfinger's news to the women sitting near her only in whispers. After that, there had been no chance to tell the men, too. But the women who could walk would do it. Risa was to look after the children, and they knew what they were to do. The other girl and the boy were walking between their mother and the woman with claw-like fingers who had wanted to take Mo back to Capricorn's fortress. Risa had said nothing to her about Dustfinger's news, and every glance the woman cast her said,
"I was right, too."
But Mina smiled when she looked at Risa, Mina with her round belly, who could have thought she had good reason to hate her for what had happened. Perhaps the flower she gave Risa in the cave really had brought luck. Mo was better, much better, after she had thought for so many endless hours that every breath he drew would be his last. Now that the prince had escaped, a horse was pulling the cart with Mo on it. The bear had set the prince free, they whispered, which finally proved that he was indeed a nightmare. His ghostly glance had made the chains disappear, and he had turned himself into a human being and cut his master's bonds. Risa wondered whether that human being had a scarred face. When all the noise had begun in the night, she had been so scared for Dustfinger, Maggie, and the boy. But the next morning, the fury on the soldiers' faces told her that they had gotten away. But where was the fallen tree Maggie had mentioned in her note? The little girl beside her was clinging to her dress. Risa smiled at the child and sensed the piper looking down at her from his horse. She quickly turned her head away. Luckily, neither he nor Firefox had recognized her. She had often enough listened to the piper's bloodthirsty songs in Capricorn's fortress. The minstrel still had a human nose on his face in those days, and she had polished Firefox's boots. But fortunately, he had not been one of those who chased her and the other maids. Up above the prisoners' heads, the soldiers were describing, at the tops of their voices, what their master would do to the Black Prince once he'd caught him and his enchanted bear again. Now that they were on horseback once more, their tempers had clearly improved. From time to time, the piper turned in his saddle and contributed some particularly cruel idea. Risa would have liked to put her hands over the ears of the little girl beside her. The child's mother was not among the prisoners, but was wandering the country with some of the other strolling players, happy in the belief that her daughter was safe in the secret camp. The girl would run. So would the other children with their mother. The claw-fingered woman would probably try to escape, too, and Sootbird, and most of the other men. The minstrel with the injured leg who was on the cart with Mo would stay. Like Two Fingers, because he was afraid of the soldiers' crossbows, and so would the old stilt walker who no longer trusted his legs. Benedicta, who could hardly see where she was going, would stay behind too, and Mina, whose child would soon be coming into the world, and Mo. The road went ever more steeply downhill. Overhead, the branches of the trees were intertwined. It was a still, windless morning, cloudy and damp, but Dustfinger's fires burned even in rain. Risa peered past the horses. How close together the trees stood, nothing but darkness showing between them even in broad daylight. The plan was for them to run to the left. Did Maggie expect her to try and escape too? How often she had asked herself that, and she always came to the same conclusion. No, Maggie knows I won't leave her father alone. She loves him just as much. Risa's pace slowed. There it was, the fallen tree, its trunk green with moss. The little girl looked up at her wide-eyed. They had feared that one of the children would talk, but they had been silent as the grave all morning. Firefox swore when he saw the tree. He reined in his horse and told the first four horsemen to dismount and clear the obstacle out of the way. They obeyed, looking sullen, handed their horses' reins to other men and strode toward the tree trunk. Risa dared not look at the roadside for fear that any glance of hers might give away Dustfinger or Maggie. She thought she heard fingers snapping, and then a whisper, barely audible. Not human words, but fire words. Dustfinger had once spoken them for her in the other world, where they didn't work, where fire was deaf and mute. "They sound much better when I say them there," he had said. And he told her about the fire honey he took from the elves. She remembered the sound very well, all the same, as if flames were biting their way through black coal, as if they were hungrily devouring white paper. No one else heard the whisper through the rustle of the leaves, the steady rain, the twittering of birds, the chirping of crickets. The fire licked up from beneath the bark of the tree like a nest full of snakes. The men didn't notice. Only when the first flame shot up, hot and greedy, rising so high that it almost brought down the leaves of the trees, did they stumble back in alarm and disbelief. The riderless horses reared and tried to break free as the fire hissed and danced. "Run!" whispered Risa, and the little girl ran for it, fleet-footed as a fawn. Children, women, men, they all ran toward the trees. Sootbird, the claw-fingered woman, past the shying horses they ran, and into the shelter of the dark forest. Two soldiers shot arrows after them, but their own horses were rearing in fear of the fire, and the arrows buried themselves in the bark of trees instead of in human flesh. Risa saw fugitive after fugitive disappear among the trees while the soldiers shouted at one another, and it hurt her to stay standing there. It hurt badly. The tree went on burning, its bark turned black. "Run," thought Risa, "run, all of you." But she herself stood there, although her feet longed to run too, run away, run to her daughter waiting somewhere in the trees. But she stayed there. She stood still. She tried not to think of just one thing, that they would shut her up again. For if she did, she would run in spite of Mo. She'd run and run and never stop again. She had been a prisoner too long. She had lived on nothing but memories too long. Memories of Mo, memories of Meggie. She had fed on them all those years when she served first Martola, then Capricorn.
"Don't get any silly ideas, Blue Jay,"
she heard one of the soldiers call back,
"or I'll put an arrow through ya."
"What kind of ideas do you have in mind?" replied Mo. "Do I look stupid enough to run away from your crossbow?"
She could almost have laughed. He'd always been able to make her laugh so easily.
"What are you waiting for? Fetch them back!"
roared the piper. His silver nose had slipped out of place, and his horse was still shying so hard as he pulled on the reins. Some of the men obeyed, stumbling half-heartedly into the forest, but retreating again as a shadow stirred in the undergrowth, growling.
"The Nightmare!"
one of them shouted, and the next moment they were all back in the middle of the road, pale-faced and with trembling hands, as if the swords they held could do nothing to defend them from the horror lurking in the trees.
"Nightmare! This is broad daylight, you fools!"
Firefox yelled at them.
"That's a bear! Nothing but a bear!"
Hesitantly, they moved toward the forest again, keeping close together like a brood of chicks hiding behind their mother. Risa heard them swearing as they used their swords to cut a path through the twining wild vines and brambles while their horses stood in the road snorting and trembling. Firefox and the piper put their heads together while the soldiers still standing in the road to guard the remaining prisoners stared at the forest wide-eyed, as if the nightmare that looked so deceptively like a bear would leap out at any moment and swallow them up, skin and hair and all, in the usual manner of ghosts. Risa saw Mo glance at her, saw the relief in his face when he saw her, and his disappointment that she was still there, too. He was still pale, but no longer as pale as if the hand of death had touched his face. She took a step toward the cart, wanting to go to him, take his hand, see if it was still hot with the fever, but one of the soldiers roughly pushed her back. The tree was still burning. Its flames crackled as if they were singing a mocking song about the adder head, and when the men who had gone into the forest came back, they brought not a single one of the escaped prisoners with them. Chapter 45. Poor Meggie. Meggie did not say a word. However hard Fareed tried to cheer her up, she just sat there among the trees, her arms wrapped around her legs, perfectly silent. Yes, they had set many of the captives free, but her parents were not among them. Not one of those who managed to escape had been injured. One of the small children had twisted his ankle, that was all, and he was small enough for the grown-ups to carry him. The forest had swallowed them up so quickly that after only a few steps, the Adderhead's men had found themselves chasing shadows. Dustfinger hid the children inside a hollow tree. The women crawled underneath a thicket of wild vine and nettles, while the Prince's Bear kept the soldiers at a distance. The men had climbed trees and perched high up among the leaves. Dustfinger and the Prince were the last to hide after leading the soldiers astray in different directions. The Black Prince advised the free captives to go back to Umbra, and for the time being to join the strolling players still encamped there. He himself had other plans. Before he left, he spoke to Meggie, and she did not look quite so hopeless after that.
"He said he won't let anyone hang my father," she told Fareed. "He says he knows that Mo is not the Blue Jay, and he and his men will make the Adderhead realize that he's caught the wrong man."
And she looked so hopeful as she said this, that Fareed just nodded and murmured, "That's great," although he could only think that the Adderhead would execute Silver Tongue all the same.
"What about the informer the piper mentioned? Will the prince look for him?"
he asked Dustfinger as they set out again. He won't have to look for long, Dustfinger said. He just has to wait until one of the strolling players suddenly has his pockets full of silver. Silver. Farid had to admit that he was curious to see the silver towers of the Castle of Night. Even the battlements were said to be lined with silver. But they would not choose the same route as Firefox. We know where they're going, said Dustfinger, and there are shorter and safer ways to the Castle of Night than the road.
What about the spelt mill? Asked Maggie. The mill in the forest that you mentioned. Aren't we going there first?
Not necessarily. Why? Maggie didn't answer at once. Obviously, she guessed that the reply would not please Dustfinger. I gave Cloud Dancer a letter for Fenolio, she said at last reluctantly. I asked him to write something to save my parents, and to send it to the mill.
A letter?
Dustfinger's voice was so cutting that Farid instinctively put his arm around Maggie's shoulders.
Oh, wonderful. And suppose the wrong eyes read it?
Farid ducked his head, but Maggie did not. Instead, she returned Dustfinger's glance. Nobody but Fenolio can help them now, she said. You know that. You know it perfectly well. Chapter 46 A Knock on the Door. The horseman Fenolio had sent after Maggie had been gone for days now.
You must ride like the wind,
he had told the man, saying that the life or death of a young and, of course, beautiful girl was at stake. After all, he wanted to be sure that the man would really do his best.
But I'm afraid you won't be able to persuade her to come back with you. She's very obstinate, he had added. So decide on a new meeting place with her, a safe one this time, and tell her you'll be back as soon as possible with a letter from me. Can you remember that?
The soldier, a fresh-faced youth, had repeated his instructions without any trouble and galloped away, saying he would be back in 3 days' time at the latest. 3 days. If the lad kept his word, he'd soon be back. But Fenolio would have no letter for him to take to Maggie. For the words that were to put the whole story right again, save the good, punish the bad, simply would not come. Fenolio sat day and night in the room that Cosimo had given him, staring at the sheets of parchment that Minerva had brought him, in the company of the terrified Rosencourts. But there seemed to be a jinx on it. Whatever he began to write seeped out of his head like ink running on damp paper. Where were the words he wanted? Why did they stay as dead as dry leaves? He argued with Rosencourts, told him to send for wine, roast meat, sweet meats, different ink, a new pen. While the smiths were hammering and forging metal out in the castle courtyards, the castle gates were reinforced, the pans for pitch were cleaned and spears sharpened. Preparing for war was a noisy business, particularly when you're in a hurry. And Cosimo was in a great hurry. The words for him had almost written themselves, words full of righteous anger. Cosimo's criers had already gone on proclaiming them in every marketplace and every village. Ever since then, volunteers had been flocking to Ombra, soldiers recruited for the fight against the Adderhead. But where were the words with which Cosimo's war would be won and Meggie's father saved from the gallows at the same time?
How he racked his old brains! But nothing occurred to him. The days went by, and despair entered Fenolio's heart. Suppose the Adderhead had hanged Mortimer long ago? Would Maggie still read what he had written then? If her father was dead, wouldn't what happened to Cosimo and this world itself be a matter of indifference to her? Nonsense, Fenolio, he muttered, as he crossed out sentence after hours of work. And I tell you what, if you can't think of any words, they'll have to do without them for once. Cosimo will just have to rescue Mortimer. Oh, yes. Suppose they storm the Adderhead's castle, and everyone in the dungeon dies as the building burns, a voice inside him whispered. Or suppose Cosimo's troops are dashed to pieces on the steep and towering walls of the Castle of Night.
Fenolio put down his pen and buried his face in his hands. It was dark again outside, and his head was as empty as the parchment in front of him. Cosimo had sent Fenolio an invitation, brought by Tullio, to dine at his table. But he had no appetite, although he liked to watch Cosimo listening with shining eyes to the songs he had written about him.
Her ugliness claimed that their words bored her husband, but this version of Cosimo loved what Finolio wrote for him, wonderful fairy tales about his heroic deeds in the past, the time he had spent with the white women, and the battle at Capricorn's fortress. Yes, he was in high favor with the handsome prince, just as he himself had written, while her ugliness was more and more often refused admittance to her husband's presence. So Violante spent even more time in the library than she had before Cosimo's return. Since her father's death, she no longer had to steal into it secretly or bribe Bobulus with her jewels, for Cosimo didn't mind whether or not she read books. All that interested him was whether she was writing letters to her father or trying to make contact with the Adderhead in some other way, as if she ever had. Finolio felt sorry for Violante, lonely as she was, but he consoled himself by remembering that she had always been solitary by nature. Even her son hadn't changed that, and yet she had probably never before wanted any human being's company as much as she wanted Cosimo's. The mark on her face had faded, but something else burned there now. Love, just as pointless as the birthmark, for Cosimo did not return her love. On the contrary, he was having his wife watched. For some time, Violante had been followed by a sturdy, bald-headed man who used to train the Laughing Prince's hounds. Now he shadowed her ugliness as if he had turned himself into a dog, a sniffer dog trying to pick up the scent of all her thoughts. Apparently, Violante asked Bobulus to write letters to Cosimo, pleading letters assuring him of her loyalty and devotion, but people said he didn't read them. One of his courtiers even claimed that Cosimo had forgotten how to read. Finolio took his hands away from his face and looked enviously at the sleeping Rosencrantz, lying beside the inkwell and snoring peacefully. He was just picking up his pen again when there was a knock at the door. Who could it be so late at night? Cosimo usually went riding at this hour. It was his wife standing at the door. Violante was wearing one of the black dresses she had put away when Cosimo returned. Her eyes were reddened, as if sore with weeping, but perhaps she was just using the barrel too often.
"Cosimo has taken Brianna with him again," she said in a broken voice. "She's allowed to ride with him, eat with him. She even spends the nights with him. She tells him stories now instead of me. She reads to him, sings for him, dances for him the way she once did for me, and I'm not alone."
Finolio rose from his chair.
"Come in," he said. "Where's your shadow?"
"I bought a litter of puppies and told him to train them as a surprise for Cosimo. Since then he disappears on occasion."
She was clever. Oh, yes, very clever, in fact. Had he known that? No. He hardly even remembered making her up.
"Sit down."
He gave her his own chair. There was no other. And sat on the chest under the window where he kept his clothes. Not his old, moth-eaten garments, but the new ones that Cosimo had given him. Magnificent clothes made for a court poet.
"Can't you talk to her?"
Violante passed nervous hands over her black dress.
"Brianna loves your songs. She might listen to you." "I need her. I have no one else in this castle except for Bobulus, and all he wants is for me to give him gold to buy more pigments."
"What about your son?"
"He doesn't like me."
Finolio did not reply, for she was right. Jacopo didn't like anyone except his sinister grandfather, and no one liked Jacopo either. He wasn't easy to like. Night came in from outside, and the hammering of the smiths.
"Cosimo is planning to reinforce the city walls," Violante went on. "He's going to fell every tree from here to the river. They say Nettle cursed him for it. They say she'd go to the white women and tell them to fetch him back again."
"Don't worry, the white women don't do as Nettle says."
"Are you sure?"
She rubbed her sore eyes.
"Brianna is supposed to read to me. He has no right to take her away. I want you to write to her mother. Cosimo has all my letters read, but you can ask her to come. He trusts you. Write and tell Brianna's mother that Jacopo wants to play with her son, and say she's to bring him to the castle about midday. I know she used to be a minstrel woman, but I'm told she grows herbs now. All the physicians in the city go to her. I have some very rare plants in my garden. Write and tell her she can take anything from the garden that she likes.
seeds, root runners, cuttings, anything at all, if only she will come.
Roxanne. She wanted Roxanne to come here.
Why do you want to talk to her mother and not Brianna herself? She's not a little girl anymore.
I tried. She won't listen. She just looks at me in silence, murmurs excuses, and goes back to him. No, I have to speak to her mother.
Benolio said nothing. From all he knew of Roxanne, he wasn't sure that she would come. After all, he himself had given her a proud nature and a dislike of royal blood. On the other hand, hadn't he promised Maggie to keep an eye on Dustfinger's daughter? If he couldn't keep any other promise, because his words had failed him so pitifully, perhaps he should at least try with this one.
Heavens, he thought. I wouldn't like to be anywhere near Dustfinger when he hears that his daughter is spending her nights with Cosimo.
Very well, I'll send Roxanne a messenger, he said. But don't expect too much. I've heard that she isn't particularly happy to have her daughter live in a court.
I know. Violante rose and glanced at the paper waiting on his desk. What are you writing? A new story? Is it about the Blue Jay? You must show it to me first.
For a moment, she was very much the Adderhead's daughter.
Of course, Finolio hastily assured her. You'll get it before even the strolling players. And I'll write the way you like a story best. Dark, hopeless, sinister.
Cruel, too, he added silently. For her ugliness loved stories full of darkness.
She didn't want to be told tales of good fortune and beauty. She liked to hear about death, ugly things, secrets heavy with tears. She wanted her very own world, and it had never heard of beauty and good fortune.
She was still gazing at him with the same arrogant look that her father turned on the world. Finolio remembered the words he had once written about her kindred.
Noble blood? For centuries, the Adahid's kin firmly believed that the blood flowing in their veins made them bolder, cleverer, stronger than all who were their subjects.
The same look in their eyes for hundreds and hundreds of years, even in those of her ugliness, whom her noble family would happily have drowned at birth in the castle moat, like a puppy born deformed. The servants say Brianna's mother can sing even better than she does. They say her mother knew how to make stones weep, and roses blossom with her voice. Violante patted her face, just where the birthmark had been such a fiery red only a short time ago.
Yes, I've heard much the same. Finolio followed her to the door.
They even say she sang in my father's castle, but I don't believe that. My father never let any strolling players through his gate. The nearest they came was to be hanged outside it.
Yes, because there was once a rumor that your mother betrayed him with a minstrel, thought Finolio as he opened the door for her.
Brianna says her mother doesn't sing anymore because she believes her voice brings great misfortune to everyone she loves. It seemed that happened to Brianna's father.
I've heard that story, too.
Violante went out into the corridor. Even at close quarters, her birthmark was barely visible now.
You'll send a messenger to her tomorrow morning?
If that's what you want.
She looked down the dark corridor.
Brianna will never talk about her father. One of the cooks says he was a fire-eater.
The way that cook tells the story, Brianna's mother was deeply in love with him. But then one of the fire-raisers fell in love with her himself and slashed the fire-eater's face.
Yes, I've heard that one as well.
Finolio looked at her thoughtfully. Dustfinger's bittersweet story was certainly very much to Violante's taste.
She took him to a physician, the cook says, and stayed with him until his face healed.
How far away her voice sounded, as if she had lost herself among the words. Finolio's words.
But he left her all the same.
Violante turned her face away.
Write that letter, she said abruptly. Write it tonight.
Then she hurried away in her black dress, in such a haste that it looked as if she were suddenly ashamed of coming to see him.
"Rosenquartz,"
said Finolio, closing the door behind her.
Do you think I'm only any good at making up characters who are sad or bad?
But the glass man was still asleep beside the quill, from which ink dripped onto the empty sheet of parchment.
Chapter 47. Roxanne.